Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a colourful slice of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we say farewell to one of Birmingham's hidden landmarks through an immersive art experience at the wholesale markets. We meet up with up-and-coming singer-songwriter Eileen Quigley to find out more about her new EP, and we explore mystery and identity through the Forwards Project's Iris. If you would like to catch up on previous shows or get in touch with an idea or an event, you can find links and more information at www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. First, we start with a goodbye. Everything Must Go celebrated the life, culture and community of Birmingham's wholesale markets as it vacated its city centre site and ended an era. I started by quizzing Sandra Hall and Lee Griffiths of Friction Arts about the approach and significance of the site, the project and its people. Okay, so I'm with Sandra and Lee.
Yep.
And we're hanging out in the wholesale market in Birmingham, which is not somewhere I hang out a lot, but there are exciting things going on here. I'm hoping you can give me a bit of colour. What's happening, Sandra, here?
What's happening tonight is a culmination of a programme of work called Wholesale Memory. And tonight's event is called Everything Must Go, and it's an experience for an audience to come around. It's going to include projection, history, performance, live music, and really, I hate the word immersive, but it is an immersive experience. And we really also want to give Brummies the opportunity to see this place before it gets demolished.
Now, that's an important point, isn't it? Because I think there's been a market of some kind on this earth that we're standing on.
For 900 years.
For 900 years, so since kind of 11th century, is
yep.
that right?
There's evidence of markets on the site going back to Saxon times, but in 1166 there was granted a charter by the king to Peter of Birmingham, who's a local lord, who lived at the manor house, which is on this site, to host a weekly market and to charge tithes and tolls on the roads. And that's how the city began, because with the market then brought the trade, and the traders then brought lots of other trade in there, and the makers, and finally the industry. So it could really be rightly said to be the birthplace of the city.
So it's a massively important area really for the identity of Birmingham, would you say?
I think so. The other thing is that this has been populated by up to 1,500 working class people working from 2 in the morning till 10. They then, a lot of them, wheel the food underneath the market into the main market so that the buyers can have it. So this site is the largest wholesale market in Europe. It was built in 1974. And I think what's really important is that there's been an entire world of people here basically feeding the rest of the city, feeding up to 3 million people a week. There's been up to 1,500 men that work from 2 in the morning till about 10. It's an incredibly fast raw retail trade. And it's really, really been working class in terms of the culture that is existed here. So we have been privileged to be on site for 2.5 years. We've been working with the guys. And tonight is really about presenting a snapshot of their lives and the things that we've seen over the last 2.5 years.
Now, in some ways, Lee, this is a kind of hidden part of Birmingham, isn't it? I think most folks, including myself, would walk past the wholesale markets without really thinking that, A, you could go in there, and B, kind of appreciating the sort of, I guess, the supply chain for the Midlands and further.
Definitely. I mean, that's something that we've really come to appreciate since we've been spending time here, is how the food gets to your table. But, it's hidden. I mean, there's literally a wall around the site. It's in the centre of the city, and people walk past it every day. It says wholesale market, so I think most people have felt that they're excluded from it, so they haven't been in. But actually, you could, when it was open, come in and just buy a bit of fruit, veg, fish, meat, whatever. And of course, at really good prices and as fresh as you're going to get it. Even fresher than the outdoor market, because it goes there after it's been here. I mean, it's going to bring huge changes when it goes, because that wall and that kind of section of the city is suddenly going to open up. I think it's 25 acres.
36.
In total, but I think most of the site is 25 acres or so, and which is huge this close to town. When those walls go down, it's going to open up the whole south side of the city. The Ray Corridor, Highgate will become much more accessible. So it's going to bring really big changes. Whatever they build here, it's going to bring huge changes, and that's partly why we wanted to do this show, to mark that change and to say to the people of Birmingham, well, what future do we want?
Now, there's a degree of finality, if you like, about this show and this kind of, I guess exhibition was probably a better word.
Experience. Is that a bit cheesy?
No, quite like okay. That. If you've said immersive, you can say experience.
Okay, thank you.
But what I was getting to is there's also a large degree of celebration about what's happening and what has happened and recognising that kind of community of interest and community of people.
It's a homage.
A homage.
It's a homage to some amazing people that we've had the privilege to work with over the last 2.5 years. I think what's also important to say is that we've been working with the most extraordinary Birmingham artists. Chris Keenan has been collecting footage. He bought a drone camera to make sure that he could get the most incredible swoops. We've got Natalie Mason doing the music. Matt Eaton's done a soundtrack so that when you step into the space, you will hear the market in surround sound. But actually everything's pretty much gone. So that will be that's going to be a really important part of the experience so that people really get a sense of what it was like to be in here every day. Then we're going to work with Birmingham Museums Trust. We're collecting all of this as archive, including the photographs of the traders, their archives, their artifacts. And when Birmingham Museum redoes their history galleries, we are going to be taking this project and putting it in the centre of it as well and working with the traders to make that happen.
So almost like a time capsule, kind of preserved forever.
I don't think we're pickling it. I think what we're doing is we're continuing to discuss the importance of working class heritage in Birmingham. So for instance, when they do the redevelopment here, you'll be able to hold your phone up and you pretty much GPSed into where the fish market was, and you will be able to press your phone and the footage will come up of that place. So that we're also doing living A archives, so people can actually access all the information and the video and the sound and the recordings that we've got, so that can kind of live on in a sense as well.
So you've obviously both done a lot of work around the market and with the project. And just to finish, is there a quirk of the market that you'll miss? Is there something that you perhaps think, oh, I really need to take a bit of that with me? A bit like the Berlin Wall, maybe.
Joe's Cafe. Rudy, who's the guy that he's the Barrow King. So you know all those fantastic old barrows? He's the only one that knows how to mend them. He's 72. He's the real spirit of the place for me. He's got the most amazing sayings. You've got two lives. You've got your market life and your afternoon life. Joe's Cafe is where people met, chatted, relaxed, got the most enormous breakfasts or type 2 diabetes, according to how much they ate. And he actually fed them. And he was a powerhouse of the market and a very, very beautiful man. And there's a very beautiful picture of him in the show.
Sharon,
that's right.
And Wendy, famously of Joe's Caf, which is a bit legendary, I think,
to say
the least. Now, tell me about Joe's Caf, which I think was on site here until very recently.
Yes, three weeks ago.
So you served your last bit of bacon, as it were?
Yeah, on the 5th of May.
On the 5th of May.
Okay. May, that's right.
So what kind of a place was Joe's Caf then?
Friendly. Most of the time.
Bizarre. Used to be bizarre.
Yeah.
You get all sorts of characters there.
So these would have been sort of traders?
Traders. Public.
Coming and going.
From
all over Birmingham, from all over the country?
All over the country.
So
regular even from regular customers, people from abroad used to come. Used to have them from, when they used to come from Spain and Holland, drivers from Holland. Yeah.
Now, somebody was telling me earlier about a legendary kind of fried breakfast that you did. Could you describe that to me?
I used to call it the Belly Buster, didn't I?
The Belly Buster.
I used to call it the Belly Buster, yeah. It had... It was the works, was it?
A dozen eggs.
Yeah. Well, about 10 eggs, exactly.
Wow.
10 eggs, 10 sausages,
yeah.
6-8 strips of bacon.
Was there a lighter version available, or was it just that or nothing?
I don't think...
No.
Joe knew a lighter version, did he?
There wasn't. He didn't know what lighter versions were. He just thought everybody ate a lot of animals.
So how long was Joe's Caf on site? How long did it exist as a... Do you know? Is it something that you...
I worked there, 38 years? And it was there before...
Wow, 38 years.
I've been there 38 years, but...
That is service, isn't it? You should get a medal.
I think the market's about... I think it was 1973, market, so the calf's been there. So it was, other owners had it before I started, so...
Now somebody else had it before Joe had it.
Yeah, before Joe had it.
Yeah. And in that time, in that length of service, which I'm still trying to get my head around, you know, that's an amazing amount of time. What sort of things did you notice had changed or were changing about, you know, kind of customers and the trade and the market?
You just watch everybody grow up, don't you? Yeah. It's like family.
You'd see them, they couldn't even reach the counter. Yeah. And then you'd see them grow up. Have children of their own.
Having children of their own, yeah. It's like family there.
Everybody knew everybody.
And so now has Joe's Calf got a place in the kind of new arrangements?
No, we're not going.
So have you retired? What have you...
No, we're not retired.
Not retired. No. Just looking to find something else.
Is there going to be perhaps a tribute to Joe's Cafe? That would be.
Yes, I think he should get a tribute because he did over 30 years, never had a day off, never had a week's holiday.
He worked hard, yeah.
He worked really hard, and I don't think he got the recognition he should have got.
And I'm guessing all the wonderful things that you used to serve from your menu, were they sourced from the market? Were they things that you got locally? Or
we got from, no, no, we got, did we,
from outside, Andy. We did buy produce from here. Like all the salad stuff salad came from stuff, here. Yeah.
You didn't tell me you did salads.
Yep.
I thought it was just big breakfast.
Oh, no. Oh,
we had a healthy corner. Sharon had a healthy corner.
I had the healthy corner.
She had the healthy corner.
Not you'd look at me and see it was healthy.
Not have you ever seen her because she was always in the back.
Was that 10 sausages and a bit of lettuce?
No,
No. Well, excellent. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. And the best of luck with whatever you do next. Yeah. And also, thank you for playing that huge, important part in our history. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks okay, thank you.
Okay, so I'm with Tyrone, whose chair... Friction Arts.
That's right.
It's a grand title.
It's a grand title, possibly, but to describe something that is quite interesting and particular.
So tell me how Friction Arts have been involved in this project and how things have come together.
Well, Friction Arts is an artist-led company. That's the first thing to say about it. And Sandra and Lee, who founded the company, have been... I suppose they've been working in communities up and down the country for years, and particularly in Birmingham and particularly in the Digbeth Highgate area. And I think they came across the whole idea of the markets and the wholesale markets and the idea of it coming to an end, and decided that actually it's a bit of history and a bit of sort of social life and a working class life that they wanted to mark in some way. And so I don't know the exact times they've spent here, but it feels like they've been here for 3 or 4 years, day in and day out, Sundays particularly, on the boot sale, and really just getting to know people and then start to find out what stories they have and then try to find ways of telling those stories.
I find it really interesting space. I find it a really interesting environment to be in when it's kind of derelict, when it's not used.
Well, that's the thing about the space. And in a way, that's the thing about this particular project, performance or the presentation, is you cannot go bigger than this space. This space is kind of, in itself, is the main star of the whole experience. And so you've got to set up something that allows an audience to sort of start to, you know, just look around the space, investigate it, discover things for themselves, and then gradually start to bring them into focus around particular ideas that Sandra and Lee, as directors of the whole event, want them to look at. And, yeah, to bring in other artists to help to bring that focus. So it's kind of, the space itself is... And that's the thing we're marking, really. This space is going to be gone, and it won't be accessible to anyone after the 3rd of June.
Now, there's a real mix of kind of media that you've used. You've sort of used film and music and bits of, I think, I guess, performance, broadly you call it that?
Yeah, that's right.
How did you sort of, you know, when this sort of hit your desk, as it were, and you thought, oh, you know, how do I tackle this? How did you kind of work around different media to use? Or were there things that particularly lent itself to the...
Well, no, what it is that actually Friction Arts works across all types of art forms, from performance to visual arts to music, and as a result has built up over the years a network of artists who work in music, who work in performance, who work in poetry, who work in photography and drawing. And so when you come to look at a project of this scale, you say, well, actually, of those artists we know, who are available to come and put something into this and make a response to this space. So I think that was the general principle, is, and it's the general principle with a company. Here's a piece of work that needs doing. What is the type of response? Is it a performance response? Is it a music response, or is it a visual one? And with this one, the space can take all kinds of.
There's something clever as well about memory, I think, about this. So we're looking at, I think, things that perhaps pass us by, i.e. things that we don't really know exist, you know, kind of supply chain things we might not have an interest in or knowledge of. And they're everyday things as well. And there's something clever about this project which sort of forces us to have a kind of, to remember them, I think.
Yeah, remember them, but also to discover them, because I was speaking to someone earlier who said, I've never been inside a wholesale market. This is the first time I've been in one of these kind of environments. And then I was talking earlier to someone who has been around this environment for the last 50 years and knows it. I myself worked as on the outside market at the Bullring opposite the old Woolworths back in the 70s into the 80s. But I never came down here either. So, I feel like I've got a connection and a memory of this place, but actually I haven't. My memory is from sort of descriptions of and imaginations of what this place is like. It's only coming here, seeing the photographs, reading the sort of narratives and hearing people talking about it, that actually their memory gets transferred over to you, and you then pass it on to someone else as your memory.
I think folks, kind of have an idea, don't they, about a wholesale market, that it's not for them, that it's kind of for traders or for folks that, have restaurants and things like that, but that's not the case. It's a very open public community.
It is a public thing, and one of the interesting things is that actually the people who are the non-public people who come in here are either people who have a tradition in markets. They know that markets are places where you simply buy and sell, and they'll come in here and do that. Or I often find it's artisans who come into places like this because there is another life going on here. And we saw a film at the start of this whole performance element that showed the life of this market, and it was quite teeming at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And you think, imagine that. There are people who are having their breakfast at that time. They're exchanging goods, making money, all at that time in the morning.
It was, what struck me about the film was that it was very mechanical in terms of the operation, but also very human. There was kind of, some folks were leaning on crates and pallets and just talking about what they got up to over the weekend or whatever.
That's right, and I think that's one of the things that we've kind of tried to capture in some of the performance element, which you may not have noticed has already begun. It's starting to seep in to the environment around us, and that mechanical thing that people are actually working, they're there to do a job, they've got to do it within a time limit, but actually they've got relationships with each other, so they can drop into a kind of quick exchange with each other and then move on, and no one's upset by it. It's kind of, and they joke and they play weird and strange games with each other, but they have a good time, and it's a fascinating environment.
Well, I shall go and immerse myself some more in some of those things. But Tyrone, thanks for talking to me. Thank you.
My pleasure. Enjoy the rest of the show.
And now, more new talent by way of Eileen Quigley. In the showbiz atmosphere of a warm Cotteridge evening, I caught up with Eileen prior to her recent gig at the Tower of Song's Ray River Roots Night.
Okay, so I'm with Eileen Quigley, and we're at the Tower of Song, somewhere kind of on the edge of Cotteridge, I think, Kings Norton, depending on how you look at the map.
Yeah, that's right. It's on the South Pershore Road, so as you're coming out of Birmingham, going towards Bromsgrove.
And it's a hidden treasure, I'm told.
It is, yes.
It is. Now, Eileen, I'm interested to talk to you first about your EP. For the uninitiated, that's Extended Player. That's like a long single, isn't
it? That's correct. It's basically, James, it's a four-track EP, and it's entitled Jumpers for Goalposts. The idea for the title actually came from when I was a youngster growing up in Glasgow. Played a lot of football with my brother and his pals, and we used our jumpers and coats for goalposts. So that's where the idea for that came. And also, I grew up about a mile from Hampden Park, So even if you couldn't go to the games, if there was a match on at Hampden, you could stand in the veranda and hear the Hampden roar, and that's actually one of the lines from that song. And on the actual EP, I've got a chap called Max Gittins. He plays Julian Pipes on that, and that gives it a kind of Celtic feel, because I've had a kind of Celtic background upbringing between Scottish and Irish.
Now, I detected from your accent that you weren't from the Midlands originally.
No, I'm originally.
You're hiding out in Wolverhampton, but you said you're from the Gorbals, I think, originally, is that
right? I was born in the Gorbals, and then we moved further south when I was about a year and a half old. That's a further south in Glasgow. So I lived in Glasgow all my childhood and all my youth, and I moved to the Midlands in the 90s.
And you've got Irish heritage. You've got your parents, I think, are Irish.
Yes,
is that right?
That's correct, but they've lived and worked in Scotland like for many years, like before we were born, myself and my brothers were born.
So how does that childhood and that kind of Celtic link, how does that come across in the music? Is that something you're conscious of, or is it something that kind of feeds through? How does that?
Not on all of the songs, but I would say the first song, like for when I was growing up, I just thought it gave an extra sort of Celtic flavour to the song. And football, obviously, growing up in Glasgow, I was a Celtic supporter, although we couldn't afford to go to all the matches.
Let's talk about some of the tracks on the EP, because there's some really interesting titles and subjects, I think. Let's talk about one called The Philosopher and the Scar Band, which is about a tragedy, I think.
It is about a tragedy. It's about the Clutha tragedy in Glasgow in 2013, where unfortunately a helicopter came through the roof of the pub, and there was 10 fatalities there. I wrote the first two verses of that track immediately, near enough after it happened, the next day, and then later on, I'd heard that one of the victims was a chap by the name of Joe Cusker. Now, when I lived in Glasgow, Joe Cusker was a housing manager when I worked for a housing department. So the last verse is kind of a tribute to him, because he, like I say, worked for social housing. So he was a great advocate of social housing and social values. So you get two verses about the pub, and then the last verse is really a tribute to Joe Cusker.
And that's quite a difficult subject matter to approach, but I think you handle it. In a lot of your music, it's very straight, it's very honest.
Yes, it is. In that song in particular, it sat with the two verses, and then I wasn't sure, and I wanted to add that last verse, and I wasn't sure if there should be another verse, but no ideas came to me, so I just left it at the three verses.
City lights are so bright, but tonight's a different night. I hear the people's plight down by the riverside. Home, 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 I'm thinking of home. The place where good folk meet, on the corner of the street, the poet and the working man, the philosopher and scaband. Home, 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 I'm thinking of home. I thought I heard Joe Cusker say that there can be a better way. Everyone will have a home, freedom to speak and freedom to roam. Home, home, home. Home, home, home. I'm thinking.
Talk a little bit about how you craft songs. We'll talk about some of the other songs as well in a minute on the EP, but was it your formative years, I guess, in the songwriting circle at the MAC? Is that
I've been going to the songwriting circle at the MAC for a year now, and that's run by a chap by the name of Dan Whitehouse. He's a well-known singer-songwriter in the Midlands, and I think he's working on his fifth or sixth EP or LP even now, and he's very good at sort of mentoring and passing on tips to people that want to write songs. I go there most Monday evenings, and then there's a chance to collaborate with other songwriters, so there's a lot of various different styles, and then people playing different musical instruments or none. But he basically focuses mainly on songwriting and the song structure. And then at the end of each term, we get a chance to play at the Hexagon Theatre in the Mac. We do one song each. So everybody that's been to Songwriting Circle that term, it's normally about 18 to 20 people over two sessions. So we play our work there too, and the public can come and watch
us.
There's
a real network. I don't think people realise it about Birmingham and the kind of neighbourhoods in Birmingham. There's a real network of songwriting.
It's quite a buoyant scene. There's quite a few open mic nights, but there's also nights designed for songwriters who write their own music, so originals. No Covers Club is run by Lloyd McKenzie, and he does that in Birmingham and Lichfield, and that's a chance for people to go and play their original songs. So people going to that night would know that it's just original songs that are going to be played.
Let's come back to some of your songs that are on the EP. There's a great track called Artificial Flowers.
Artificial.
It's about time, is that right?
It's about time and it's about life in general. It was inspired basically by a bouquet of flowers I received a long time ago by an elderly relative. And it's just how different flowers, the real flowers, one by one they die. Some types of flowers die before others. But at the end, it's only the remnants, the artificial, say artificial fern, and wood that's left. And it's just a kind of reflection on how life can be sometimes, that sort of sense of life and then renewal. And it's
I kind of, when I heard it, I kind of thought maybe they were sort of a symbol of kind of accepting things that aren't perfect, if you see what I mean.
Yes, that's the great thing I think about songwriting is people can interpret songs in their own way. You can write a song that can mean different things to so many different people. But yes, yeah, that is a good explanation of it. That could easily be.
Artificial flowers never die. Artificial flowers never die. Imitation posy or ring-a-ring-a-rosy. Artificial flowers never die. Lilies fragile, petals white, tulips bright, will fade with light. Roses true, lose their perfume, but artificial flowers never die. Chrysanthemum, its splendor wanes. Daffodils have springtime fame. Carnations, friendship lasts a while, but artificial flowers never. In grandeur stood synthetic fern and acorn wood. Watch as nature takes its course. Artificial flowers never die. Artificial flowers never die.
And the other track, I think, which is a great track, which is very kind of open heart, if you like, if I can call it that, is Soundtrack of Life.
Yeah, Soundtrack of Life is basically about staying positive through all the ups and downs of life. Everybody has ups and downs in their life, and if you can just hang on to the next day, even if you've had a bad day, the next day can be better, or you can go about maybe doing something to make it better.
Most of those tracks on that EP, Jumpers for Goalposts, you can get online, can't you?
You can download them all on Spotify or Amazon, or they're available also on Bandcamp and SoundCloud to stream if you don't want to download them. And you can also get EP by EP from my own website, which is
eileenquigley.com.
There is a physical CD.
You haven't got any vinyl or anything like that yet?
I don't yet, no.
Yeah. And in terms of your ambition, in terms of where you want to go and where you want to take this, where are you on that journey? I mean, obviously, you're kind of, are you in your first steps in terms of taking the songs on the road and seeing
Yes, I would say I am. It's only recently that I've wrote songs before, and I've maybe recorded songs, but I've never put them out so that the public can download them or actually own them. And that's what I've done now with Jumpers for Goalposts. I'd like to, I tend to go to Glasgow once or twice a year, so I'd like to get a gig up in Glasgow before the end of the year and possibly some other cities. But I'm just playing locally just now and finding my way.
Homecoming, as it were, that kind of thing. Sing loud to drown out the Hampden roar, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you could say that. It'd be nice to have that louder crowd.
And let me just ask you, just to finish, in terms of being Glaswegian and having quite a strong accent, you know, accents do come, sometimes accents come across or sometimes get lost, don't they, in music and songwriting?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Jumpers for Goalpost track, it's got some Scottish words in there,
yeah,
and Scottish slang, like when
there's
you were young
slang,
and growing up. But now the rest of the songs, I just sing them how I speak. I don't normally speak with a lot of slang, but it suited that song.
And importantly, as most singer-songwriters get bigger and more famous, they collect more guitars. So how many guitars have you got hiding away at home?
I have just got two guitars. I have one other guitar at home, which is a Crafter. The guitar I've got with me tonight is a smaller guitar, which is a Martin guitar. And the only reason I got that is because, back to the football theme again, I was trying to keep fit a few years ago, and I joined a ladies' football team, Whirly Cougars, they're called, over 30s. But while I was training with them, I fell and broke my wrist, so I don't have any backward movement on that wrist, so hence the smaller guitar.
Right.
Because I was struggling a bit with a larger guitar.
It's always got to be a reason, I think, isn't it?
So, but Whirly Cougars, they went on to win the Women's League, I think, Staffordshire this season.
There you go, so. A quirk of fate, as it were.
Without me.
So, Eileen, in terms of where people should go to find out more, you mentioned some of the places people can download the EP. There's also eileenquigley.com.
Yep, that is my website. You can get information about me there, information about my upcoming gigs. You can get SoundCloud links to all the tracks. You can buy my EP from there. So that is the central point if anybody wants to find me. And then you can just click on the links to that to my social media accounts. Twitter's probably the one which I use most.
And what about gigs and performances that you've got lined up? Are you doing a few festivals coming up?
I don't have any festivals as yet, but I'm playing at the Crescent Theatre in Birmingham City Centre on the 25th of June, and then the Songwriting Circle Showcase at the Hexagon, that will be on the 2nd of July.
Excellent. Well, it's been great to catch up, and I'm going to look forward to your set later on here at the Tower of Song. But for now, Eileen, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much, James. Thanks for speaking to me.
Thank you.
When life is making you weary and nothing is going your way, look up to the sky, hold your head up high, tomorrow will bring a new day. We will sing and dance in the evening, we will sing and dance at the dawn, though the night may be dark, or you're up with the lark, the soundtrack of life carries on. We can step on the stones, cross the river, on the ladder we'll climb every rung, every throw of the dice, all the mysteries of life, the challenges we'll overcome. We will sing and dance in the evening, we will sing and dance at the dawn, though the night may be dark, or you're up with the lark, the soundtrack of life carries on. The hands on the clock keep on turning, in the blink of an eye they've moved on. To know that each moment is precious, for time is to live, not to own. We will sing and dance in the evening, we will sing and dance at the dawn. Though the night may be dark, or you're up with the lark, the soundtrack of life carries on. We will sing and dance in the evening, we will sing and dance at the dawn. Though the night may be dark, or you're up with the lark, the soundtrack of life carries on. The soundtrack of life carries on.
You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy. For more on the artists and projects covered in the show, go to our blog, www.thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. And now, as promised in our last show, more from the Innovative Forwards project, which has worked over the last couple of months to meld sound clips, stories, and new composition into an impressive body of musical exploration. Steeped in mystery and lost in a churchyard, I went in search of Iris. So I'm with Ian Francis, who's director of Flatpack Projects. I'm sneakily reading his badge, and we're at St Barnabas Church in Erdington. And we've just seen the performance of Iris. Now, Ian, let's start by exploring how Flatpack have become involved in the Forwards project.
Okay, so it definitely wasn't our idea. This is all the brainchild of Bobby Jane Gardner, obviously. We've been running a film festival in Birmingham for over 10 years now, as well as doing various other projects. So we're known for mixing film with other art forms and a bit of an interest in using space in interesting ways, I guess. So Bobby approached us last year to ask if we'd be interested in teaming up to commission an artist for one of the new pieces this year, and Iris has been the result.
So what were the kind of factors in that commissioning process? What were you looking for? Who are you approaching?
I think it was really, as much as possible, finding people with a connection with the place where a lot of the work is going to be happening, rather than just bussing in someone. So when we knew it was Erdington, we straight away thought of Scott, because we've worked with him in the past, and I know he's got a real history of the place. You know, he's spent his youth and his adolescence here messing around with his guitar and making little films and getting into mischief and doing graffiti and what have you. So I thought it would be great to bring him back, and explore how the place has changed and work with groups here. So I think that's and also Scott's skills, I guess, are a good match. It's nice to have a visual element for us, although it's not essential. A lot of our work has some kind of moving image component.
Now, Scott himself is a bit of an elusive character, which fits really, because Iris, the kind of concept of Iris, is a mystery, isn't it? In a narrative, a mystery of someone who perhaps
is here, was here, might not have been here?
So the idea is she was an organist at St Barnabas, and the story's kind of emerged gradually in the process of putting the whole project together. And then in 1968, she strangely, mysteriously disappeared in the churchyard, and we're not sure what happened to her. So the whole project's been an attempt to piece together her story using footage and audio, and who knows where she may be.
And you mentioned the kind of local links, and the Forwards project is very locally based. How have you sort of helped facilitate some of that kind of local involvement, getting people...
We can't take a massive amount of credit for that, I have to say. I think a lot of the work for that is down to Bobby and Jeanette and the Forwards team, and Scott himself, who's done a lot of digging and found primary school who were willing to work on it, a local history group, and also the Polish cafe in Erdington High Street. And that's been one of the really nice bits about it. I think it's when you add up all the different Forwards commissions and think about the number of different people around the city who've been involved in different ways, it's kind of mind-boggling, really.
Now, you mentioned a key year there, which I think Flatpak themselves are doing more around 1968, a year of revolution and protest.
Indeed.
Across most of Europe.
Yeah.
A little bit more tame, I think.
That would be your assumption, but in fact it's not true. I always assume the 60s didn't really reach Birmingham until the 70s, but it turns out they did in all kinds of ways. And I think generally people think of Enoch Powell in relation to Birmingham in 68. That's the thing we're famous for, sadly, is the Rivers of Blood speech. But all kinds of student protest, lots of bands starting life, interesting venues. So in terms of Erdington, you've got Mothers, which is just over the road from here, was voted one of the best venue, rock venue in the world by Billboard magazine a couple of years running, for an incredible range of acts who played here. And one of those acts was Black Sabbath, who were also started life in Aston in 68. Obviously, the whole city was being demolished at the same time. All kinds of kerfuffle around the cultural changes and the planning changes that were going on. So it's a moment of change for the city, and the idea of the project is to revisit that and look at the resonances that it has for Birmingham now. In some ways, you can see the birth of the Birmingham we know today in the late 60s.
So if folks want to find out more about what Flatpak are up to and the 68 project in particular, where should they go? Where should they find you online?
Flatpakfestival.org.uk is a good place to start, and there'll be more info about the 68 project going up as we go along. We've got a whole team of volunteers who are digging into different aspects of it, the music scene, the student protest side, and all kinds of other stuff. So yeah, look us up online, or write to my68@flatpakfestival.org.uk.
Excellent. For now, Ian, thanks very much. Thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm with Sam Owen from the band Pram, who we'll find out hopefully more about very soon. But Sam, you've been involved in, I think, some of the musical elements of the Forwards project, and in particular the kind of Edgbaston project.
That's right. We were one of the first lot of composers last year. We were involved with Edgbaston Ward, which is four different areas. So Harborne, Bartley Green, Edgbaston itself and Quinton. And we worked with community groups in those four areas. So Martineau Gardens in Edgbaston, lovely group of volunteers that work in the gardens there, a women's group with kids in Quinton, a school, Chad Vale in Harborne, and a local history group at Woodgate Valley. So we went round with them and recorded sounds in their local area, and then worked with some of them to actually come up with some ideas for the finished tunes and concert, and then we did a performance at Martineau Gardens in the sun, amazingly.
So the folks that you enlisted for those projects, how easy was it for them, or how accessible was it for them to sort of you know, come along to a project and to start sort of thinking about sound and music? Were there any sort of barriers that they found? Or
I think if you give people the chance to be creative, usually they jump at it, and yep. I think people did enjoy it. I think it was a little bit bemusing at first, particularly going out recording sounds in the local area. People were wondering what it was all about, but they really seemed to, you know, enjoy it. And then particularly the workshop we did with some of the people at Martino, some of the volunteers. We were playing with sounds like rain, bees, a squeaky wheelbarrow, and then looping those. And so they had a palette of sounds that they'd been recording to make into loops and tunes, and they got really engrossed with it, I think. So I think it's people like to be creative, and I think once people are adults, they don't get so much opportunity to play and be creative. And so I think generally, given half a chance, anyone will enjoy it, I think.
There's that notion, isn't there, of kind of unlearning creativity over time. Do you know what I mean? It kind of dissipates over time.
Yeah, I think it can be difficult sometimes to put, as an adult, to put away your kind of rational thinking head and let things move you without thinking from the, you know, from the emotions, if you like. Or I always think that the first thing that comes out of your head is quite often the most interesting, because it's not filtered by the kind of rational, fearful brain that you develop as an adult about worrying about what you're doing and what other people would think of you. It comes from somewhere a bit deeper inside.
So we're kind of, I guess, at the sort of culmination of the Forwards project. Things are sort of coming to the word I use was crescendo. I like to use that word, mainly because it sounds good. But what do you think the kind of legacy of the project will be? What do you think it will leave for people and for communities?
There's been a lot of people involved in the different areas, a lot of community groups over time, and of all ages and all backgrounds, and I think that will hopefully stay with them. I certainly feel a few of the people, you know, just speaking from our own experience in PRAM, some of the people we worked with did feel that it had affected part of their lives in some way, I suppose. So I think there'll be a remembrance of this project. But I think any creative and musical project, quite large scale, that has funding in Birmingham is going to encourage other things to happen. And it's been great that there have been partners involved as well. So for example, the performance today was partnered up with Flatpak, the fantastic film festival. We were partnered up with MAC, the Midlands Arts Centre. So I think there's a legacy there in involving those organisations.
Okay, well, Sam, for now, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
Okay, thanks.
So I'm with Bobby Jane Gardner, who very helpfully helped us out in the last show, telling us what Forwards was about and where it was. Mm-hmm. And we're here now in St Barnabas Church in Erdington, and we've just seen the performance of Iris, which, as we were saying, was very intense, in a good way, very positive. But Bobby, help us with where we are. Create a map for us in terms of the Forwards project, because it's kind of coming
like
to an end.
Like geographically where we are, or well, what do you like?
Geographically, culturally, you know.
Oh, okay.
Maybe so, a temporal thing as well.
Oh,
you know?
Okay, yes. So basically, James, we are in the last 2 weeks of this 2-year citywide project. We are, right now, we are in Erdington. We're in St Barnabas Church, where we've just experienced the first of 6 events. Which will be the culmination of the end of the project. And composer, sound artist, filmmaker Scott Johansson, who was raised in Erdington, has just performed a piece that's a collaboration between 4 community groups based in Erdington District. And it was also kind of like had this narrative which is based on local history about a lady called Iris Threadwell, if I'm right, who apparently went missing at this church. She was last seen at this church. And so I'm presuming, I haven't seen all the workshops, but in terms of dialogue with these community collaborators, they've devised this piece that explores the mysterious nature of this, and it's quite sci-fi in places. But I also love the fact that it incorporated the community voice. You could hear the beautiful musicality of the Brummy accent, like young kids saying, you know, something like Castlevale. And I'm just processing and just this epic performance. It's just been an audio-visual performance.
And there was a real mix. I think that's a good way to describe it. It's a real mix of very local input and local, I guess, local flavour, because, you know, you can hear people talking about Castlevale being upmarket or being up from the market or going up market. There was something around that.
I think so. I couldn't quite... I'd need to hear it again. But it was quite mesmeric as well, because just like it was like these repeated these sentences have become like almost like mantras. They're repeating, and after a while you just kind of let go, and you just I listen to just the sonic quality, the sounds of the voices, and just how musical the accent is as well. So
now it was very mysterious, and I think and there was an eerie element to it as well. And just to give folks a flavour of what I mean by that is, there was one of the projections was at the churchyard. Of where the performance was taking place, with a kind of shadowy character moving in and out. We were presuming was Iris, but we didn't know. And I wonder how that story was kind of unearthed. How they discovered this kind of this mystery.
It's a mystery to me. I don't know. And I think that members of the audience have approached Scott, and he's been very.
He's a very enigmatic character.
Yes,
as well,
he is.
Isn't he?
Even in terms of taking a bow, he was like, you know, still hiding behind the screens a little bit. I think he just want to give the game away. He wants to keep up that air of mysteriousness, and I think the story's unresolved anyway, so why would he want to resolve it?
Now, all of the projects that you've been working on for Forwards have been very different, I think, in different places, and they've taken different tacks and involved different people.
Yes.
But I'm just wondering, what is there a common thread across the projects so far? Have you thought about that? Is it too early to ask that?
Well, okay, the reason why we've got such a diverse array of composers is in response to the pilot project that I ran in 2014, 2015. And at the time, I was studying at Royal Birmingham Conservatoire doing a master's. And the team of composers are three of us working in three neighbourhoods, Small Heath, Newtown, and Balsaheath. We had the same lineup. It was quite a contemporary classical lineup. And members of the audience, in their feedback, said, why do you have the same lineup for different parts of Brum? So in response to that very valuable feedback, I decided that, why am I doing that? Like, why can't the makeup and the sound of each district be different? And rather than me choosing it, get artistic partners to direct that as well. So, the diversity is really, really key. And, like, there's six performances. We just had the first this year, of the second year. And, like, next week we're going to have electroacoustic stuff. And in the afternoon we're going to have jazz. And then on the third and final week, we will have Grandmaster Gareth, who is like a kind of like pop, like upbeat stuff, I presume. And then we're going to have Simon Duggle, who is very much your popular commercial kind of sound. And then ending with a dubstep producer in Sutton on the 1st of July. So I think that the reason for that diverse multi-genre sound is in response to what happened in the pilot. And in regards to the common thread, the common themes, I think the framework has tried to be part of that, or to create that, which is field recordings. So by me kind of stipulating to each of the composers, myself included, that they had to go out with the community collaborators and record sounds they best thought were representative of the area or that they found interesting. Every single composer has done that with the 40 groups involved in this project. And also community voice, stories, that kind of stuff that's happened. One, naturally, it was a byproduct of the field recording aspect. That, again, these two elements, if you like, are a springboard for the creation of new music. And I think that also, in terms of hyperlocality, all the composers have to have a really strong connection to Birmingham. And I would say, out of the 10, how many of us are Brummies? I think maybe 8 out of the 10 groups of
That's
composers.
A fairly good quote,
7 or 8.
It, I think.
And there's in Hodge Hill District, Justin K. Broderick is from Shard End in Hodge Hill District. Erdington District, Scott grew up here. And then in Ladywood District, Sosa Cole grew up there as well. Hall Green District, Grandmaster Gareth grew up in Billsy in the area.
You've done pretty well with that.
So local, and it's just saying that there's so much talent here as well. As Brummies, we're renowned for our self-disparaging sense of humour, you know, we're not like other cities like Manchester or London where we're like, whoa! But that's starting to change, I think. So I think that they're the common, the localness, how local are you, that kind of aspect is what's binding it all.
It's a great, I think, cultural kind of snapshot of kind of where we are and what's happening.
Mm.
And last time we spoke, I sort of flippantly asked you if you've been hiding in hedges and making recordings and things. And one thing that I was intrigued by was, in terms of those audio recordings and those kind of clips, if you like, were there things that you recorded or that you found that you were surprised by, things that you didn't think you would hear in Birmingham? I mean, I think a lot of people think Birmingham's quite a busy industrial place, which it is, but it's also a very quiet, very rural place.
Okay, well, I worked in Selly Oak District, and I worked with some local poets based in Sturchley and Bourneville Ward. And I had never heard of a carillon, which is an instrument that was that is like it's bells, but they're triggered by like these wooden mallets or hammers that are made up like in the form of a piano. And I'd never heard of this instrument. And so my collaborators said, "This is an instrument that is so local to this ward. We have to use it." So initially, we just recorded the sounds of that carillon. And then it became the instrument we used. So that was a new thing for me, a new aspect. Do you know what the best thing to do is? All these field recordings are on the interactive website and you can listen for yourself and you can decide.
You can find out more information on the projects, a sound map and lists of those clips at forwards.co.uk. That's forwards.co.uk. That's forwards.co.uk. And just before we go, a quick update on our favourite in-house band at Mac, Switch. They'll be performing on Friday the 29th of June at 7 o'clock in the outdoor arena as part of Switch Sunset, and they'll have support from the Warriors. It promises to be a lively evening for all of the family and a great way to start your musical weekend. If you'd like more information or tickets, you can contact Mac on 0121 446 3232 or go online to macbirmingham.co.uk. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Eileen Quigley, Friction Arts, M7PR, 448 Creative, Mac Birmingham, Bobby Jane Gardner, Sam Owen, Ian Francis, and Flatpak Projects. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.